we're going to go straight to the end of the parsha, which is source number 20. Ela ha mitzvot asher tziva Hashem et Moshe el bnei Yisrael bahar Sinai. Now, at first glance, the pasuk is somewhat unremarkable, or even we can say the other way around, to a certain extent, would be predictable. And, I mean, it's a nice way to finish. You know, these are the things. And one of the things that I'll note is something which gets a lot more emphasis in the beginning of the first of our two parshiot, and that's this element of Har Sinai. These are the mitzvot which God commanded at Har Sinai. Now, one of the things that the commentaries are going to note is over here it says, these are mitzvot, and just it says mitzvot without anything else, Tziva Hashem, et Moshe el ben Israel. We can compare that to a previous ending. When I say an ending, there really was an ending, and that's somewhat of a problem, which we'll see if we can address it at all tonight. And that's the source before the end of source 19, which is the very end of the Tochacha. Eila ha-chukim va-mishpatim. So here you have v'hatarot. So instead of just mitzvot, you have chukim, mishpatim, v'tarot. Asher natan Hashem beino uvein b'nei Yisrael v'har Sinai b'yad Moshe. So the elements which are the same is, you know, if we'll be very general, you have God, you have Moshe, you have Har Sinai, and you have Yisrael, but aside from that, there's lots of other things, little things along the way, which are a little different, and the truth is that this is something which really should be worked out. What is the difference between the two different endings? Why is there a necessity for a second ending when you already had a first ending? What's added in the rest of chapter 27 of Kaf Zayin? Why do we need more after we had a pretty good ending? But there's another issue that I think we also need to pay attention to. And that is, you know, again, I hinted at this, that when we talk about Parshat Bahar, so then we get, let's say, we can do the normative, let's say, what Rashi would say, source number one, V'deber Hashem Moshe Behar Sinai Lemar. And that gets, you know, the commentaries going. What do you mean Behar Sinai? Why now, of all places, does it say, is there an emphasis on Har Sinai? But the question is actually a little bit stronger than that. And that's why especially I want to compare or to contrast the very beginning of the Sefer with the very end of the Sefer. So where do we start Vayikra? We start Vayikra with what I would probably imagine, and again with Rashi, as being some kind of a whisper or a very soft voice. Vayikra el Moshe, Rashi tells us, Lashon Chiba, and where does this take place? This is in the Mishkan itself. Meaning, and then you have to link it back to the very end of Sefer Shemot. In Sefer Shemot, the Mishkan is completed, and Moshe is waiting, but he can't enter because the cloud is there, the cloud has descended, and finally Moshe is able to go in, and he hears a voice which then speaks to him, this loving, soft voice of the Shechina addressing to Moshe. So it's interesting that the book begins with God speaking and the sound coming from the Ohel Moed, and the book ends with this description of God having communicated to Moshe at Har Sinai. And we wonder exactly what it means when it says Har Sinai here. Does Har Sinai indicate a chronological issue? Does it indicate a geographical issue? If, for example, the Mishkan was still sitting by the foot of Har Sinai, would it be then appropriate to say that's what it means by Har Sinai? And by the way, if that's what it means, then what was so special about the Parsha beginning that God speaks to Moshe at Behar Sinai? And as we said, there are all kinds of teachings about this. So I want to start now all over again, having said all that, and once again observe what the book is about. There is a chizkuni someplace towards the end of Vayikra, which tells us every single thing in Vayikra is about the Kohanim, and that's why it's Torah Kohanim. I'll tell you the truth. I don't know how he says that. I mean, there's enough other things in Vayikra that are not exclusively about the Kohen, but there's something else. And that is something that we've been noticing along the way, this subtle shift which is taking place. We start with this very private, and for that matter, very intimate I'm not sure if it's a monologue or a dialogue, but I'll imagine it as of now as a monologue, which takes place. God is speaking to Moshe, very, very private. Along the way, Moshe is going to have to share information, become more public with it. But we end up with Har Sinai. Now, part of Har Sinai gives us this, and it, again, this will completely depend on your imagination. When I speak about Torah Misinai, does that mean God speaking to the entire people? And that's loud, and that's with thunder and with lightning. Or I'm imagining Moshe going to the very top of the mountain, and God speaking to him again very privately. And for that matter, the private lessons which Moshe receives on the top of the mountain perhaps are reminiscent of what takes place in the very beginning of the book. But there's another issue. And that is that the Sefer is a Sefer about Kedusha and about holiness. That is what the book is about from the beginning to end. And we've seen this enough times moving over the last couple of weeks. I really want to emphasize this and be a lot more specific than just use the word Kedusha. So the book begins with the only place that we know of as of this point that has this geographical sense of Kedusha, and that is exactly what God had says, Vasuli Mikdash, Vashachanti B'tocham, although the Tocham is something which can fool us. Is that the Mishkan that we're talking about, or is that the Jewish people that we're talking about? B'tocham. But nonetheless, especially with the background which we understand, that after the Cheta Egel, when God says that I won't be among you, and now God is among them. I mean, that's the thing which has changed. And with all of these thoughts in mind, I want to start now the beginning of the parsha and go a little bit. We'll do a little detail. But again, we know what we're looking for. We know where we're going to end up. We know how the book ends. I ruined it for you. We know how it ends. I also want to keep in mind that we know what the text or the subtext is. The subtext is holiness. So we know exactly what we should be keeping our eye on now as we start to move ahead. So with that, V'yidbar Hashem Moshe b'Har Sinai. God speaks to Moshe at Mount Sinai, saying, and I've skipped a little bit, but what's introduced right now is a sabbatical year, and that may come as a surprise, that not only does the idea of Shabbat, the Sabbath, affect the seventh day of the week, where now we're told that there's such a thing as V'hayta Shabbat Ha'aretz. There's also such a thing of a Sabbath which affects the land. By the way, that should right away tell us something. Because Shabbat is holiness in terms of time. And now we're being told that we have a Shabbat in terms of place. So right away, we now understand that there is going to be this other type of holiness or a continuation of holiness which we may or may not have anticipated. On the other hand, maybe this is not a big surprise at all. The Jews are supposed to enter the land of Israel, but you know what? What have we been told about it? It's a land which flows with milk and honey. What are we told about it? Well, we've been given a couple of, I'm not going to say hints along the way, we've been a couple of instructions along the way that this is a land which can't tolerate certain things. But now, with the addition of the Shabbat Ha'aretz, now we understand that just as Shabbat is something which is so essential, Shabbat is something which is testimony to God creating the world in 6 days and resting on the seventh. So now we have the application of that word Shabbat coming to the land of Israel. V'yitah Shabbat Ha'aretz, lachem lachla, lacha la'avdecha l'matecha, ulischircha ulitoshevcha hagarim imach. Now that's actually a very interesting turn of phrase, and it's going to be another subtext here. I'll just have to, you know, I don't know how many times something has to be repeated before we can then say, oh, look at that, that's a subtext. So I'm letting you know that that's a subtext, and we just now notice the first time that it's mentioned. Ulatoshvacha hagarim imach. The people that live with you, but who are they exactly? So the Shabbat Ha'aretz, on the most fundamental level, we're not supposed to work the land, but we can still eat from the land. And I'm not going into any practical discussion on Shemitah today. Skipping a little bit in the same source, just the next verse, what we've gone from Zion to Kaf Gimel, to verse 23. Now that itself is important. Ki li ha'aretz. Here we're talking about selling the land and the return of the land, but God says, I want you to know something, the land is mine. Now, ultimately, the demand of keeping a Shabbat Ha'aretz comes back to the exact same point, that God is that which endows the seventh day with holiness. God is what endows the land of Israel with holiness, and therefore there's a Shabbat Haaretz. But over here, again, it says, Ki gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. Now, that same phrase that we had, that I pointed out before, which was ulatoshvacha hagarim imach, over here it's gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. It's the same phrase, it may not have the same meaning at all, but it says, Ki li aretz, ki gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. You are living with me, which means essentially we have entered into the palace. And there are certain rules when you live in the palace. There are certain things that you can do, you know, in your own place. But if you're in the palace with the king, with God, then one has to be far more careful. And that is exactly what's being said over here. Pasuk Lamed Hei continues along the same kind of theme. And we'll see the phrase again, and maybe yet a different meaning. V'yihi yamuch achicha. Now, what does the word yamuch mean? Yamuch would mean he came upon hard times. If you... In Lamitet, the word is used again. Am I correct? The Targum uses a word that some of us are familiar from the modern Hebrew. I think we fail to appreciate to what extent Aramaic is part of modern Hebrew. Somebody is a misken. What is a misken in modern Hebrew? A misken is somebody who's unfortunate, falls on hard times. Other words that, if you want from Aramaic, include grandfather, Saba, and almost as important as Saba is Glida, is also an Aramaic word. So if your Saba brings you Glida, so that is, you almost have an Aramaic sentence there. You probably need to stick another Aramaic word in there with it. V'chi yamuch achicha umatayado imach v'echzaktbo ger v'toshav v'chay. Imach. So again, this phrase of the ger and the toshav, which we had previously as garim v'toshavim atem imadi, and l'toshvacha hagarim. So once you have three times a phrase being used in a short space, then you realize that there is in fact a subtext. That was my point, and that's what we need to understand. And over here it says that if your brother, you know, comes upon hard times, your brother is a miskein, you need to help him. Now, we just now had two very different terms. One was achicha, your brother, and the other was ger v'toshav. Ger has a connotation of a stranger, but it's a stranger who lives with you. So a ger would be, I would say, the opposite of achicha. He's not achicha, he's a ger, but he's a ger who's a toshav. But what else did it say over here? V'chzaktabo, help him up. Now, if you didn't notice, there is this subtle or not so subtle shift that took place. On the one hand, if your brother is on hard times, your brother's a miskin, then, you know, put out a hand and help him, give him a helping hand. And also the ger v'toshav that lives with you. Now, ultimately, again, we have to understand something. The ger v'toshav is the stranger who lives amongst you. But we were told, ki li ha'aretz, God says, this is my land, ki gerim v'toshavim atem imadi, that you guys are the... Now, again, I may be overstating it, but you are the strangers who I'm letting live with me. So it actually helps us set up the relationship. And as I said, we need to still understand what exactly is this meant, is the issue over here or the subtext over here. Right afterwards, it says, Pasuk Lamed Vav 36, Al tikach mito neshach v'tarbit. Here we're talking about if your brother needs help, don't lend him money, but don't do it with interest. V'yareitim elokecha. You mean we need to be God-fearing. Don't say, okay, I'm going to make my money work for me. No, your brother needs help, give him money. V'chei achicha imach. Your brother shall live with you. I gave a short 5-6 minute shiur today, and I quoted something on that verse, V'chei achicha imach, which I want to mention as well now. The Gemara uses that verse where there is an argument between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Petura. The Gemara is in Bava Metzia, it's also in the Midrash Halacha. If two people find themselves in the desert, and one of them has water and the other one doesn't have water, but if they share the water, they'll both die. But if one keeps his water, he'll live and the other one will die. Ben Petura says they should share the water. And when you see the way it's taught in the Midrash Halacha, you realize that he quotes the verse, V'chei achicha imach, your brother shall live with you. So how does he understand this? Your brother shall live with you, even if it's going to be for a limited amount of time, your destinies should be the same destinies. On the other hand, Rabbi Akiva quotes the same verse, and Rabbi Akiva says, you keep the water. He says, V'chei achicha imach, Chayecha Kotman. Rabbi Akiva obviously puts the emphasis on with you, and therefore you need to establish yourself before you can help somebody else. If you don't know how to swim, you don't jump in the water to save somebody who's drowning. If you have water only for you, you don't give it to somebody else because that's going to kill you. Which means for Ben Petura, the process is what's important, and two people should live together and die together. And for Rabbi Akiva, what's important is the end result, and he sees an absurdity that two people should die when one person could be saved. And I'll say it again, they both learned it from the same exact verse. Nonetheless, there's something difficult about it. And again, parenthetically, there's a whole halachic discussion among the Achronim whether, according to Rabbi Akiva, you can give the water to the other person, and that doesn't interest me as much. But what I do want to note is something which I found, and probably a commentary who you would not necessarily have anticipated. One of the those of you who every week when you watch the shiur, you just look at the books in back of me and try to see what's the new book which is there this week, which wasn't there the previous week, because it really does depend what I'm doing that. But there is a book which I put there this not that long ago because I opened it up and found the following quote. The quote is from, I'm not sure who wrote it, and I'll explain to you what I mean. I know the name of the author. I just don't know who wrote it. The name of the author is somebody by the name, who you know of. His name is Elie Wiesel. The question is, who wrote it? Was it the young Hasidic kid who grew up before the war, who had a great deal of emuna? Or did Elie Wiesel, who came out of hell and was upset with God, and we are not in any position to judge such a position. So who wrote this? So, as I said, I have a question. And the truth is, it's a beautiful book. It's called Sages and Dreamers, Biblical Talmudic Hasidic Portraits and Legends. And he has a chapter on Rabbi Akiva. And towards almost the last part of the chapter, there's another paragraph or so afterwards, he writes the following. In conclusion, I love Rabbi Akiva. I love him for his humanity, for his passion. I love him for his love of the Jewish people. His argument with Ben Petura on the duties and obligations of friendship, his decision teaches us something important. When the surviving friend emerges from the desert, he's no longer alone. He will have two lives. He will have to live two lives, his own and that of his dead friend. And what he doesn't tell you is that he's teaching, and I searched for this idea. I could not find anyone else who said it. He's teaching you what the pasuk means, v'cheyachicha imach. He's saying is that your brother shall live with you when one of you survived and the other one didn't survive. Now, the psychologist can tell me if this is survivor's guilt or if this is something else, but it's a fascinating concept in terms of when some die and others live on. So those who live, and we don't know why God does things, and of course, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm referring to what happened last week. We don't know why things happened. We can't stand in God's place and say why things happened. And we all realize there's an absurdity in this. And the truth is that this has very little to do with God. This has to do with man. If I survived, then that creates a responsibility. And the way that he is interpreting Rabbi Akiva's teaching of this responsibility is my brother shall live with me. And now I have to live a dual life. Now I have to live the life of the survivor, but the survivor therefore now has the added responsibility of living the life of who didn't survive. And I think it's the most fascinating read in how Rabbi Akiva is understanding the verse, V'cheyachichi imach, now your brother lives on with you. So we'll pause with that understanding, with that idea, but I want to go back to the verses again. So let's go back and continue, because we have this ger and the toshav and garim and the toshavim, and it's God's land and there's holiness, but there's this stranger among us. And at the very end, we're keeping in mind and how the whole thing ends. The whole thing ends as this is what God commanded to Moshe at Har Sinai, or not just the mitzvot, maybe it's the other things as well. And as I said, the dual endings, we still have some confusion. So let's try to move on and essentially try to get to a little bit more confusion. Because one of the things we're told now is that when somebody is weak or poor, put your hand out. And the hand out is for your brother, but it's not only for your brother. It's also to help not just your brother who is a miskin, not only your brother who has become weak, but it's for others as well. So we'll pause at that and we'll continue. And in Pasuk Lamed Chet, verse 38, it says, "And Yeshem Elokeichem Asher Hotzeiti Etchem Me'aretz Mitzrayim Latet Lachem Et Eretz Kanan Liyot Lachem Le'Elokim," which means this relationship, you're in my land and we're living together. I am your God. We are living together. It really speaks of this relationship. And again, V'chi Yamuch Achicha, when your brother becomes a miskin, when your brother becomes weak, when your brother becomes, runs into a cash flow problem, when your brother becomes poor, and he now is forced to become some kind of a servant, don't treat him with a lack of dignity. Kisachir, kitoshav. Now you notice that word again. Kisachir, kitoshav ye'imach. He should live together with you. Don't look at him as being somebody who now is working for you as being inferior. He lives together with you. Achnat yel ve'yavod imach. And you notice, again, how many times it's the tashuv, and now it's the shav, and then it's the yashuv, and there are plays going on, again, linguistically, that seem to be quite important. And then God tells us why. Ki avadayim, asher hotzeiti otam mi'eretz Mitzrayim, lumkum mimkeret aved. Because when it comes down to it, all of you I've acquired once I took you out of Egypt. Lo terderdo befarech v'yaretu melokecha. Do not treat them harshly, work them hard. Rather have fear of God. Skipping a little bit, Pasuk Mem Zayit, v'chi tasig yad ger v'toshav imach. And now you see that phrase coming again. V'chi tasig yad ger v'toshav imach. Umach achicha imo. And now you have this unfortunate brother who now is going to go work for the stranger that lives among you. V'nimkar leger toshav imach, o le'eker mishpat ger. Which means, previously we talked about the Jew who's on hard times, help him out. Somehow somebody didn't help him and he got himself into a more complex situation. He ends up becoming, the word in Hebrew is either slave or servant, however, and it's saying don't treat him as a servant, but that's when the Jew bought him. Now what happens if someone else does, who's not Jewish, this stranger who lives among you? So the Torah says, Achrinim kar gula tielo, echad mechav yigalenu. O dodo, o ben dodo, yigalenu, misha'er b'saro, mishpechato yigalenu. A relative, somebody, a brother, a cousin, an uncle, somebody, should go and get this person out of the situation. We have an obligation of helping people, which is really fascinating because the whole background over here, you know, as much as we like to today to use the phrase social justice, that's really what this parsha is about. But the social justice emerges out of our being cognizant that we live in a land which is a holy land, and the holy land belongs to God. As much as we would like to think it's ours, it's not ours. God is essentially saying, this is my land, I'm letting you stay over here, but there are going to be rules. And the rules are such, and again, I want to throw one more word in, because that's where we began. We began at Har Sinai, which is really where holiness emanates from to a very great extent. That's where the Torah emanates from. That's where God chose to make us into a holy nation. Which means when you start thinking, okay, Ma Inin Shmita Eitzah Har Sinai, I don't know if that's the fair question. The fair question is, Ma Har Sinai, what's it doing in the middle of Shmita? It's not the other way around. Is why is Har Sinai being mentioned over here? And that is because Har Sinai is where holiness flows from. That is the core of the holiness. That is where God opened up the heavens. That's where God appointed us as a mamlechet kohanim v'gai kadosh, which means that's where it comes from. And now we're being reminded of Har Sinai specifically when it comes to stressing the holiness of Israel. But now we went a little bit further. Yes, on Shemitah, I have to realize I don't own anything. On Shemitah, I have to open up my property and say, anybody who wants to come and eat my produce, come and eat it. And that's everybody there, by the way, including the strangers, including the animals, including my neighbors, everybody can come and take the food they eat. Everyone's allowed to eat the produce of Shvi'it, of Shemitah. That was where we began. But it proceeded from that to tell us that it's not just that there is this ritualistic thing of the Holy Land. No, it's that it somehow has to become something else. And it's not just a question of ownership. I let somebody else eat the land because I don't own it right now. No. It's much more than that. It's that there is going to be a new type of a society where I have to remind the landowner that ultimately that God is the owner of all property. Now, once I understand that, I move further and I start thinking about these other issues that were just now brought up. And the important issue over here is actually going to be the strangers. Because isn't it true that you judge a society by the way that it treats the disenfranchised? You judge a society based upon the way that the weakest people in that society are treated. It's no interest, really, how the heroes are treated. It doesn't make a difference if it's sports heroes or military heroes or entertainment heroes, which sports heroes ultimately are. It makes no difference. It's how do we treat the have-nots? And that's what really has been the subtext over here, where God is telling us at the same time, be careful when you treat another servant, because you were servants. Don't treat him like a servant. Treat him with respect. You have a brother who runs the risk of crashing and burning. Put your hand out and help this person. No, not with interest. Help this person. And even if there's a stranger that lives among you, help him as well. And again, right then, it got a little bit more interesting in terms of the stranger who lives among us. It's that point that I want to try to explain a little bit more and say things which maybe are not as well known as they could be or they should be. But the last thing that we had over here was if somebody now was bought by one of the strangers, then make sure that you help them out as well. And again, as we get towards the end of this section, Pasuk Nun Hei, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. Avadaihem, asher otzeiti otam mitzrayim, ani Hashem Elokeichem, which again sets up the relationship. You are my slaves and I set you free, which means you cannot take another one of your brothers as a slave because you're my slaves, all of you. That's essentially the price that was paid when I freed you. I freed you from Paro, but I didn't free you from being my slaves, as it were, and therefore you can't enslave one another, and so on. But now let's go back to our Ger V'Toshav. Rashi in source number 3 tells us, what's a ger toshav? And he starts off with a problem. Afim hu ger o toshav. Now, a ger normally would mean one of two things. Either it mean a stranger, or it could mean a convert. So here Rashi says, af hu ger o toshav, eiz o toshav, kol shekibel olav, shelo la'avod avoda zara, va'ochel nevelot. Now, I hope, well, not that I hope, I'm not convinced that all of you were expecting that interpretation of what exactly is a ger toshav. My suspicion is that if I would have asked you before I read that, what's a ger toshav, that you would have told me it's somebody who has accepted the 7 mitzvot of Bnei Noach, the 7 mitzvot of Bnei Noach, the 7 Noachide laws. But Rashi didn't say that, and for good reason Rashi didn't say this. As I'll explain, Rashi actually only pointed at two things. One is that he's accepted upon himself, kibel, he accepted upon himself, that he will not worship idolatry, and he will, and but he eats nevela. What's nevela? So there's two things, trefa and nevela, and we will take a look at this as we go on. What exactly is the nevela? What exactly is the trefa? A trefa is an animal. Literally, it means ripped. It's an animal which died through, she will say, non-natural causes. And nevela is something which could have died from natural causes as well. That was a terrible definition or explanation, but I'll work on it. I'll try a more precise one soon, hopefully. Source number 4, which actually is quite connected to this section here, because it spoke about even the ger toshav, you should help him out. Ger toshav mor l'inyan ribit mayhi dichtiv v'chi yamuch achicha umatayo. Which was a very confusing verse when you start to really pay attention. Who is it you can't take entrance from? Is it only from your brother, or is it the ger toshav? Why is the ger toshav in the middle of that verse? And I'll say it again, that just now became very complicated. Rashi here writes, ger toshav, shekibel lav shalola avod avod kachavim v'chol nevelot. So Rashi gives us the exact same interpretation. Who is it? He's somebody who took upon himself not to worship idolatry, but he's somebody who's able to eat something which is called a nevela. It's non-kosher food. He eats that. Al tikach Me'ito k'tiv achichakai. That's talking about your brother. V'chi k'tiv gerto shav le'inin v'chai imach or imcha k'tiv shatam mitzavato l'achiyato. So, the way Rashi explains the Gemara, and again, he really had to parse the words of the verse, that there's a difference. When it comes to your brother, you're not allowed to take interest from another Jew. But when it comes to saving the person's life and living with him in peace and harmony, I would almost say brotherhood, but it is brotherhood, but it's just that you can't, the actual brother you can't take interest from. Over here you could take interest, but you're obligated to save his life, which means that this person is drowning, you can't just walk away. No, this person is a human being in the image of God, and you must save. Now, the important thing over here is actually that this person has rejected idolatry. And that's going to be so important. I'm going to try to explain more about this as we move on. But first, just a word about Nevela and Trefa. Source number 6, it says, Anshei Kodesh Tiuli, you should be holy. Ubasar Bisadeh Trefa, you find an animal that was ripped to pieces and it's dead on the ground. If you're tempted to eat it, it says, don't eat that. But what do you, it's not kosher, but what do you do with it? Lo tochelu lekelav tashlichunoto, give it to the dog. And here the rabbis tell us the dogs didn't bark when we left Egypt. They get rewarded and we give them this food that was found in the field. On the other hand, in the book of Devarim, in source 7, it says, chapter 14, verse 21, Lo tachlu kol nivela, you're not allowed to eat nivela, leger asher b'sharecha titnana, but rather you give it to the stranger who lives among you. Now, obviously, it can't be a ger tzedek, a convert, because a convert has to keep all the commandments. So this is this ger toshav that we are referring to, or you can sell it to somebody who is not Jewish. So it's interesting. What's the ger versus the nachri? The nachri is the stranger. The stranger is somebody who actually still believes in idolatry. So you can sell him the non-kosher food. But the ger, the stranger who lives among you, who we previously saw were obligated to take care of, to give him a helping hand, to help this fellow out, this is somebody who's a neighbor. He lives with us. Someone who's rejected idolatry, that person you give the nevela to as opposed to selling it to the idolater. Because you're holy and therefore you can't eat this, but you are there to help this stranger. So again, the stranger is interesting. Rashi in source 8, which is on that verse, says, the ger shebe shorech, ger toshav. And by the way, now the commentary made sense from all the other places. Who's this? This is the Ger Toshav. Now, what makes him a Ger Toshav as opposed to the Nachri? I'm going to say it again. It all came down to this verse. You give it to the Ger, or you sell it to the Nachri. That is what forced us to make a distinction between the Ger and the Nachri. The Ger is what's called a Ger Toshav. He's not Jewish, although I'm going to say more about that in a couple of minutes. He's not Jewish. He lives amongst us. We take care of him. He's somebody who is a good neighbor, and we do what we can to help him. And we have non-kosher food. You hand it over to him. But when it comes to the idolater, that's something else. And by the way, Judaism had a war against idolatry. I don't know any other way to soften that or say it differently. There was a war against idolatry. That was the reality. So the idolater was not able to just be your neighbor and sit over there and so on. We had an obligation. You know, the same way that there was an obligation to get rid of chametz before Pesach, we have an obligation of getting rid of and searching for and getting rid of all idolatry from the land of Israel. So the idolater who may have been around you, that idolater, you have no obligation to be helping. Quite the opposite. You perhaps have to convince him not to be an idolater. And the Rambam very much goes in that direction. But on the other hand, that's not the person who you're living in peace and harmony. The peace and harmony is the non-Jew who has rejected idolatry, but, and that's why we keep on saying this, but he eats non-kosher food, because that's what the verse says about him. You give him the non-kosher food, which actually then means that there are at least three kinds of categories which were just now presented. One category is a Jew, the other category is the non-Jew, and the other category is, now how do you want to put this, the non-Jew who lives among us in peace and harmony, who we take care of, we put out a helping hand for them, and so on and so forth. Now, again, what is the status? Well, we saw all that we know about him as of this point is that he's rejected idolatry. He still eats non-kosher. So I want to say what's in my mind, because you can't read minds. at least some of you. Before this whole episode happened with Meron, you know, this tragic episode, there was another story which was in the headlines, which then just like completely disappeared. There was a fellow who had lived in Jerusalem, him and his family, who was impersonating a Orthodox family, and he impersonated a rabbi, as a rabbi, and as far as we know, he performed weddings. I'll qualify that in a second. Circumcisions. He wrote tefillin, wrote mezuzot, and came to Israel. He was being paid by a church as a missionary. So I was consulted about this around a month ago, long before the story broke. Not all the information I know now I knew then, but what I did know was that he came to Israel. He was being paid by a church. He was found out, but he said, no, I've done tshuva. I've repented. Now, repenting is not enough if you're not Jewish, because you still need to convert if you want to live in a Jewish community as a Jew. I guessed at that point, and I'm still guessing, I think what he did to try to prove that he was Jewish, I think he went to a very prominent Beit Din in Philadelphia and said that he was married and couldn't really prove he was married, but said, I want you to write a get. I want to be machmir and write a proper get. And he had them write a get for him. They said, no, who cares? We'll write a get for someone. What does that say? I mean, it's just a piece of paper. It means nothing. There's no Shem Hashem, no anything. So he took the get from the prominent Beit Din and then said, look, I'm Jewish because look at this Beit Din that gave me a get. And they wrote the get for me. So I think he was very clever, and he leveraged the get from a really good Beit Din to try to prove his Jewishness. But he was involved. When I say, I know he performed weddings outside of Israel in Messianic congregations. And I was asked about reporters know if there should be a story about this, and I said, listen, facts that you know you can and you should tell, don't embellish, don't lie. Don't say anything which isn't the case. I think that there is a story that a church is paying someone to infiltrate a Jewish community. If he has decided that he has somehow become a Jew along the way, I think a Jewish community has a right to know exactly how that happened, especially somebody whose track record is such that he was not Jewish and was trying to infiltrate. When he was learning in the yeshiva when he was first found out years ago, and that's when he said he did tshuva, and then he disappeared and moved into another community, and they had lost track of him. But as I said, more than a month ago, it was already known who he was, where he was. His wife had tragically passed away of cancer. A lot of people had helped him, and some of the people that were closest with her were the ones who had been in touch with me. And I also knew another thing about the story, which they didn't know, and that was that he was actually working in a gym as an instructor, and everyone else working in that gym were, in fact, Messianic Jews. And there he was in his, you know, Hasidish clothing working in this place. As I said, to me, it was a very simple question that one is allowed to publicize such information. We can have a whole discussion about the laws of Lashon Hara if you want. I felt that it was the proper thing to do. I felt that that maybe he could go and prove that everything is kosher at this point. What happened instead is that one of his kids went to Beis Yaakov and told one of the other girls that Jesus loves her, and that's how the whole thing ended up exploding. Anyway, if he performed weddings with nice Jews, were sincere, which I don't believe is the case. I don't know for a fact one way or the other. Most of you hopefully know you don't need a rabbi to perform a wedding. You need a ring owned by the chatan. We could argue if the woman is very important, that maybe it's different. You need a ring. You need two kosher witnesses. That's what you need to get married. Afterwards, it's nice to have a ketuvah. There are other things and all, but that's what you need. If the rabbi is not Jewish at all, it doesn't make that much of a difference. What you need, technically, I've seen too many things go wrong by too many weddings, who's a kosher witness, and so on and so forth. But I'm just saying, the simple point, do you need a rabbi to form a wedding? The answer is no. There have been too many cases of young men who've gone over to young women in jest, Hareyat Mekudeshetli, and hands them over something, and there's no rabbi over there, and then these things very often become complicated. Full stop. What about the tefillin that he wrote? What about the mezuzah that he wrote? So I'm going to tell you something, and you're going to be shocked, most likely. But I'm not saying this halacha l'maisa, because nobody's asking me halacha lemaisa. But I'm saying this because I think it's very relevant to our parsha, and it's very relevant to Ger Toshav, and it's very relevant to our discussion. Now, first of all, you can say to me, hold it a second. This fellow here lives among us, so what's his status? Is he a Ger Toshav or not? Now, presumably, and maybe you'd be more comfortable not to speak about this person himself, but to talk about the theory. But if somebody lived among us, and made believe, I want to leave the part for a second, makes believe an Orthodox Jew. So a non-Jew lives among us and believes in Jesus. Is a non-Jew allowed to believe in Jesus? So that's a good question. There's actually, it's written in the Shulchan Aruch, and the question is how broad to take this concept. There is from Simon Aleph to Kufnun Hey is all about getting up in the morning, putting on your tzitzit, talid, davening, and all the way through. And from Kuf Nun Zayin onwards is going to be about the laws of brachot and eating and so on and so forth till we get to things like Shabbat. But there's one little section in between, which is Siman Kuf Nun Vav. It only has one halacha to it. I put it over here. Kuf Nun Vav. Source 29, right? So from the beginning to Kuf Nun Hey is all about prayer and so on, ritual, and from Kuf Nun Zayin onwards, it's about some food, brachot, and so on. Kuf Nun Vav. Achar kach yilech la'ach sakav. And then you go to work. By the way, that's actually a halach in the Shulchan Aruch. I know a lot of people look for heterim, that they don't have to. To kol Torah she'eini mamalach sofa b'teilu v'gorer tavon. Anybody who learns Torah but doesn't have a job, they're going to end up sinning. Because the poverty is going to end up causing someone to sin against their creator. But still, you don't have to spend all your time working. And hopefully both of them will be accomplished by him. And one should do business with honesty, and one should be careful not to use God's name in vain. It's very easy when you're, I swear that this is brand new. I swear that this cow, I swear about this car, whatever it is. No, don't take God's name in vain. So it goes on a little bit about being careful not to swear. And then it says, be careful not to have an idolater, that's very specifically not a non-Jew, an idolater as a partner. Maybe he'll have to make a vow. You're going to be forced either to swear by his God, or he's going to swear by one of this idolatrous God. There's going to be a problem. Haga, the Rama adds, v'yeshman kilim basiyat shuftim im akum bizman hazeh. The non-Jews today are not the same as the idolaters of past days. Mishun she'ena akum bizman hazeh nishmeh bavodat edelim. They don't swear by idols. V'afal gav dimaskim ravodat zarah. And even if they say something which we may consider to be something which is idolatrous, mikol makom kavanatam la'osei shemayim ba'aretz. When a Christian says, I swear by God, he is speaking of God who created heaven and earth. Ella shemishvim shem shamayim v'davar acher. But rather, they believe in, for a lack of a better word here, he says, a trinity. V'lo matzino sheyesh b'zem mishum v'vnei v'lo titin michshol. And we don't find that that's a problem to have him say something, because in his mind, he may be thinking about the trinity. But then it gets a little bit more interesting, and he writes, "The harei einam mizharim al hashituf," because non-Jews are not obligated not to believe in a shituf, which, for lack of a better term, I'm going to say is a trinity. Now, the question is over here, is that a broad statement, or is that only regarding the laws of vows? And I'm not going to go any more into it than I just now did. Nonetheless, we have over here halacha on the Shulchan Aruch, first saying, hold it, be careful about having business with an idolater, because someone's going to say the name of a false god. But then it says, yeah, but if it's in today's world, no. They, when they say God, they mean the creator of heaven and earth. Okay, they believe there's a Father, a Son, and a Holy Ghost. Okay, that's it doesn't, for a non-Jew, that's not considered to be heretical. That's really what it said, because even when they say, and by the way, part of it is, to have a deep discussion, explain what exactly is the Trinity. How do you understand that? But nonetheless, they believe in a contradiction, in a monotheistic God who created heaven and earth, but somehow the monotheistic God has three aspects. And It's not the simplest thing even for them, but I'm not going any further into this, I keep saying that, than I already did. So now I'm going to go back and ask a question. What about our Ger Toshav? So our Ger Toshav rejects idolatry. He says, I believe in one God, but can he believe in Shituf? I don't know the answer to that question. Does this preclude someone from being a Ger Toshav or not? And the whole question about the mezuzah maybe being kosher or not may depend on this. And you're going to say to me, what am I talking about? So, look at source 26. There's a Magen Avram, who, if you don't know, Magen Avram is quite authoritative. He writes, "Destam alkom ein bekim lechtov bevaday Yisrael yichtu." Okay, katzu bedarki Moshe. Afal gav to besefer Torah mamzer beger toshav psulim beger toshav can't write a sefer Torah, right? Nonetheless, nearly the betfilin umizuzot en lachush. That nonetheless, a ger toshav could write tefillin umizuzot. So now, you don't know what to do with yourselves right now because the Magen Avraham really wrote that. The Bir Halacha, both in 27, which is in Siman Shin Dalet, and is also in Bir Halacha in Lamed Tes, in Source 28, he says some things, and I don't really know what his bottom line is, but we need to know one more Gemara, and then we could explain this as well. And then we'll see some interesting things. But I just want to look in 28 words bold. V'teda, and you should know. The Atu im Isha ve'Evid yikablu aleihem mitzvot tefillin yukshayron lichtivat tefillin. That a woman or a slave, if they accepted upon themselves the mitzvah of tefillin, yes, this is the Bir Halacha written by the Chafetz Chaim. If they accepted upon themselves the mitzvah of tefillin, they would be allowed to write tefillin. And later on over here he explains also regarding the Ger Toshav and so on. And I know that you're thinking, what in the world am I even reading over here? But the same thing is over here in terms of Shabbat regarding the Ger Toshav, and that's what Shindalit is. So let me explain, and then we'll see how it goes back to this parasha, and then hopefully we'll understand a lot more than we understand right now. In source number, we already got to the Nevel and the Treif. In source number 9, Mishpatim, Sheishet Mim Tasem Alacha, Tasem Asacha, Uviyom Ashvi Tishbot. 6 days your work, the seventh day you rest. Laman yinuach sharcha v'chamcha v'yinafesh ben amatcha v'hager. In order that you rest, and it talks about your animals, and also the people that live with you, the ger. Now this ger cannot be, right, by definition, this ger cannot be a ger tzedek, a convert, because of course he has to rest on Shabbat. The Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, source 10, Gemara in Kritut. Ger Toshav mutar lasot melacha b'Shabbat. The Ger Toshav is allowed to do work on Shabbat. Now, of course, he could do work on Shabbat. Why? Because he's not Jewish. Ger Toshav mutar lasot melacha la'atzmo. But then the first opinion is, ki Yisrael b'chol ha'moed. Now, what in the world does that mean? Is a Jew allowed to do work on Chol ha'moed? Well, the answer is, yeah. He can do something which is called Dover Ha'avud, which means fundamentally we can't do work on Chol ha'moed, but we can do work on Chol ha'moed if there's some kind of need. Now that's a very strange statement. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Ki Yisrael b'Yom Tov, that a Ger Toshav, for him, Shabbat, is that, now Yom Tov, what is, we have all the malachot, except we're allowed to cook and we're allowed to carry. And Rabbi Akiva says, that's the law of a Ger Toshav. Now all of this should be a little strange. Rabbi Yossi says, Ger Toshav also b'Shabbat, latzmo, Ki Yisrael b'chol, that for him, it's like regular week. Like, what are you talking about? And I know that for some reason, in our minds, we seem to more connect with that last opinion, but nonetheless, those other opinions are still here. So I want to pause to make sure I didn't lose you completely along the way. We're talking about that we're going to live in this land. We're living in God's land, and this holiness in this land. And then there's strangers going to live with us. But now we realize something, that the stranger who lives with us, somehow the holiness which we have starts to spread and impact that stranger as well. And the commentaries, or even the Tanaim, are having a little bit of a hard time to identify exactly or precisely how the holiness impacts them. I want to get to Rabbeinu Gershon in a minute, but first I want to, I mean, the Tosfot that I'm skipping, 11 and 12, part of what it ends up saying is that maybe a Ger Toshav doesn't have Shabbat himself, but he can't do anything. He can't be a goy shel Shabbat. By the way, now you say, okay, so he's a stranger who lives among us, but he can't be a goy shel Shabbat. He can't be a Shabbos goy. You know the famous joke, Jacob Katz was a historian. He said that thank God that historians aren't known by the name of their books, like the Ktzos was known as by the Ktzos. Because Jacob Katz wrote a book called Shabbos Goy. He would have been known as the Shabbos Goy, Jacob Katz. But what's a Shabbos Goy? And many, many, many holy non-Jews have been Shabbos Goys over their life. A couple of years ago, when we lived in our old house, we had a neighbor who was Swedish. And he himself had converted, but he had an old friend who used to come from Sweden every year. And one year, Friday night, I don't even remember what it was, but something was forgotten, a mistake, and we needed someone to help us. So I knock on his door and I said, Hans, can you help me for a minute? And it was Friday night. He was wearing his Swedish pajamas, which was quite a sight. He looked a little bit like Santa Claus, maybe even a lot. And he comes out of his house, and he starts walking. He goes, you need something? And then he gets excitement because he realizes. He says, am I going to be a Shabbos Goy? And I said, yes. A Shabbos Goy? And I never saw a man so excited. I mean, Jews on Simchas Torah was not excited as this man was. And he came, and like all day he was in heaven. Because he was our Shabbos Goy. But over here it's fascinating because Tosa says that it's a Ger Toshav, he can't do anything for you because that's the level of Shabbos that affects him. But let's take a look at 13, Mespe. Gemara says, hold it. What is Ezo Ger Toshav? What exactly is a Ger Toshav? First opinion is, Kol Shekibe Lolav Befnei Gimel Chaverim Shalol Avod Avodos Chachavim. The first opinion, Divir Meir, the first opinion is, he says, I won't do any idolatry. Chachavim Omim, Kol Shekibe Lolav Shev Mitzvot, Shekibe Lolav Bnei Noach. The second opinion says no. Somebody who accepts upon himself the seven Noahide laws. Acherim omrim im lo bo leklal elu lo ba leklal ger toshav. No, that's not a ger toshav. Ela ezo ger toshav ze ger ochel nevelot. Somebody who eats nevela, he eats non kosher food. Shekibel alav lekayim kol mitzvos amulis betorah chutz mi iser nevelos. But he doesn't eat nevela, right? It doesn't work. But he accepts all the commandments other than nevela. Other than eating non-kosher foods. And I want to pause for a second. The Mugen of Rum that we saw before understood that a Ger Toshav is somebody who can accept as many commandments as he wants. He can accept 5 commandments, 10 commandments, 20 commandments. If he accepts tefillin, what is the criteria to write tefillin? The criteria is whoever puts on tefillin accepts themselves that they put on tefillin. Now, some of us are obligated, so therefore we can write tefillin because we're obligated to put on tefillin. I saw a question among the Achronim. If you're if you don't wear tefillin Rabbeinu Tam, are you allowed to write Rabbeinu Tam tefillin? So the one who asked it, Yismach Moshe, he says, well, certainly you just don't think you're in a high enough level to put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, so you can still write it. Excuse me. What if you don't put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin because you're a follower of the Gra, and the Gra completely rejected the concept of Rabbeinu Tam tefillin? And by the way, I'll mention parenthetically that those who don't know Rabbeinu Tam tefillin are puzzled according to Rabbeinu Tam for multiple reasons. Rabbeinu Tam tefillin is a complete misnomer. According to one issue, it follows Rabbeinu Tam, but all the other issues Rabbeinu Tam would consider them absolutely puzzle, and therefore it's a little bit funny. And you say, I'm not writing Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. You want me to write it? Fine, pay me. I wouldn't wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. So can that person... So as I said, the Achronim need to keep busy, so this is one of the ways they keep busy. But if somebody is a Ger Toshav, that was the Mugen of Rama, the Bir Halach understood it. If he accepts upon himself this mitzvah, so therefore, now he's part of that mitzvah. He's part of Uvukshartem, of putting on tefillin. So therefore, he could be part of Uchsavtem, and he can write it as well. So I needed everything I just now said was just to get to source 14. This is the famous Rabbeinu Gershom. Those of you who wanted that second, third, or fourth wife, this is the one that stopped it. Those of you who wanted your husbands to take a second or third wife, this is the same Rabbeinu Gershom. Source 14, what does he say? Ger Toshav shekibel lav shelo lavod avod chavim v'lo kibel lav shar mitzvot. Ki Yisrael b'chol ha-moed, going back on that opinion, he's like a Jew on chol ha-moed who can only do davar avod. Why? Klomar kevin sheyesh bo k'tzat gerut. Because he's a little bit of a ger. K'tzat gerut. So therefore, there went everything that we know. You remember that you were going to tell me before, you think, oh, when I say, can you be a partial Jew? And you would probably have said to me, can you be partially pregnant? And I probably would have said, yes. And how? I don't know. But he just said you can have ktsat gerut, which means there is some kind of middle category. There is some middle ground. There are Jews, there are non-Jews, and then there are partial Jews. And you say, what do you mean a partial Jew? So now going back to exactly the complication of a Ger Toshav. when we live in the land of Israel, the holiness of the land, we take other people in. All you need to do is reject idolatry, then you can come and live in the land of Israel. The land of Israel cannot accept idolatry. You come live in the land of Israel, so everything is good. But now what happens? What happens is the holiness then spreads about and creates new realities, and the other people that are there are now in a position to accept other commandments. And these other commandments they accept upon themselves create something which is very interesting. And again, I'm going to say there is not a universal understanding, either by the Tanayim or the Marayim, or for that matter, going all the way till today, what exactly is this thing called the Gerut Toshav. I will tell you something, that those who complained against the Heta Mechira, one of the things they said is that you're not allowed to sell the land to somebody else, they're not allowed to be here. But you could sell the land to a Ger Toshav. Now, technically, there's also another question. Could they even be a Ger Toshav in this time period or not? And that itself, I would say, the stronger opinion would be no, but there are dissenting voices. The last Shemitah, the land was sold to a man whose family came from the former Soviet Union. He served in the Israeli army, and he was somebody who was completely, some of his children or grandchildren were Jewish. He was somebody who was completely involved in the life in Israel. And he was the one who bought the land, and a Beit Din declared him a Ger Toshav. And therefore, the complaints of the Chazon Ish and certain various others in terms of how can you sell the land to somebody, I mean, that was part of the argument. No, you're breaking a bigger law by selling the land than you would by keeping, by even breaking Shemitah. That falls apart with the Ger Toshav. But now you realize the complexity of this Ger Toshav is that he's someplace in the middle. There's a lot more I wanted to say today, but I see time slipping away. So I'm going to say very quickly part of what I wanted to say, and I want to look at one last source before we finish. The flip side of everything I'm saying is in Parsha Bechukotai. The flip side in Bechukotai is, I just want you to see that these are mirror images of one another. Parsha Behar is about living the land of Israel and God's land and everything is holy. The flip side of it is Bechukotai when we go into exile and then we lose all aspects of holiness. As we lose all the aspects of, but now I have to be careful. Is it every aspect of holiness? Which means why do we go there? Because we broke the covenant. Now what happens? We're still obviously obligated, but something has happened. God was among us, but now we're kicked out of this land. Which means the whole problem, Bichlkotai, is really emphasized when you read carefully, not just Behar, when you read the two of them together. The years we read Behar and Bechukotai together are good except for one problem, and that is that I run out of time to say what I wanted to say. But the holiness aspect is actually in the inverse in Bechukotai, and that then creates the problem. And I think that's part of what the two endings are. I've said in previous years, we end, everything is good. At the very end, God will take us back. At the very end, the land will remember, and the covenant with Avram, with Yitzchak and Yaakov, or Yaakov and Yitzchak and Avram, and the land will remember, and we're going to come back. And then there was, and then we get this another chapter, and the chapter talked about vows, and it talked about Temura. And what exactly is Temura? Temura is this idea that when you try to, you make something holy, and then you try to move the holiness to something else, that doesn't work. The first thing retains its holiness. So I always thought that that was fascinating because somebody could have read through all of Bechukotai and said, look, the Jews broke the covenant, and therefore God has rejected them. The way I explained this to my students this week, it's when somebody steals your identity, identity theft. Identity theft on a cosmic level is replacement theology. Is when the church comes and says, we are the new Jews. We're the ones who God has made the covenant with. You've been rejected. You're no longer Israel. And that's why I found it fascinating that right after this whole discussion of the Tochacha, then the next chapter is, oh yeah, by the way, things can't lose their holiness. But I want to read one last commentary. And Abba, this is the family of your neighbors. Now you have to know, which neighbor am I talking about? You'll see in a second. This is source 24. It's Shir Ma'on, I think that's how it's pronounced, of Shimon ben Rav Avram Shmuel ben Yamin Sofer Schreiber. That's the family of the Chassam Sofer. He was born in 1850 in Pressburg. His father was the Ketav Sofer. His grandfather was the Chatam Sofer. His great-grandfather was Kiva Eger, by the way. He studied under his father in 1800 when he received rabbinical position in the city of Eger, Hungary, which was called Erloy by the Jews, where he served for 64 years. In 1944, he was killed in Auschwitz at age 95 together with his entire community. So the early Rebbe today is Beis Medrash, is across the street from where my parents live. So he writes the conclusion of the Sefer, Eilu ha-mitzvah asher tziva Hashem et Moshe b'nei Yisrael b'har Sinai. Yesh lomer kodum zektiv v'yahu utmur so yekodesh. That it and the thing that replaces, they're both kodosh. The first thing doesn't lose its kedusha, its holiness. V'zeshe gam hu gam t'mur so kodesh. It and the thing that replaces it both remain holy. Hu nilmad b'har Sinai. Because that's the pasuk we ended with. That was learned at Har Sinai. Meha, how, the shivre luchos v'luchos gam shnehem menuchim ba'aron. That both the broken tablets and the whole tablets, both of them were together in the Aron Kodesh. That what we learned by Sinai. V'zema shemisayim eila mitzvos. These are the mitzvos. Hainu shegam t'muraso kodesh shetivah shemetz Moshe bar Sinai v'kal lahavin. So what exactly did he say? He said that, again, what I noted in terms of this law of Tmur at the end, so he didn't take it in terms of Christian theology and replacement theology. What he took it in terms of saying, that's what we learned at Sinai. That was exactly the lesson of Sinai. The lesson was the Jews messed up, and there was a golden calf, and the luchot were broken. But what happened to those luchot that were broken? They never lost their holiness. Yes, there are replacement. There's a new luchot afterwards, but the old ones never lose their holiness. And I think what he understands is that they don't lose their holiness, which means that even if we sin, and even we make mistakes, and even if we get broken, still holiness doesn't disappear. And nonetheless, there's going to be new lucho, but the holiness never disappeared from the first one, and that's part of what was taught at Sinai. Now, whether that is the covenant at Sinai, whether that is the brit at Sinai, or that is the lesson at Sinai. Because if I say it's the covenant at Sinai, which, by the way, is really the way the previous chapter ended, the problem is you may break a covenant. And if you break a covenant, you break the rules, you say then it's all over. That's why you have this additional chapter. Even if the rules are broken, holiness doesn't disappear. The holiness is retained, even if it then has to take upon some new kind of aspect. And that's why his example of the luchot in this, I think, is absolutely stunning. It's absolutely beautiful the way that he is saying this, which means the whole book of Vayikra is a book of holiness. We may mess up and not live up to the level of holiness that we need to. The perfect world is we get to Parshat Bahar. That's the perfect world. Perfect world is total acknowledgement that God runs the world and God gave us this land and God is living with us in this land. And other people are welcome to join us in this land. They just have to know that God owns the land. They can't believe in idolatry. They have to know that God is in this land. So therefore, that understanding then creates this holiness to spread and to affect other people. I'm going to say in a fascinating way, where the Ger Tosher becomes, in the language of Rabbeinu Gershon, something in between Jew and not, and he does accept mitzvot. And the way the Magen Avraham seems to understand him, and they can accept more mitzvot, and the next day more mitzvot, and the next day more mitzvot, till he finally gets to the point and says, you know what? I'm not going to eat the nevela anymore. I'm rejecting the nevela. And at that point, he accepts all the mitzvot. So it's fascinating to see that that's what happens. On the other hand, when the Jews go into exile, are we going to be impacted by those around us? Is the non-holiness going to then seep into us? Are we going to cause holiness to completely disappear? And that's why there is this uplifting end of the entire book. Holiness ultimately will not be disappeared. Holiness itself, the Jewish people are not going to lose this holiness. Maybe we'll be broken. But even broken Jews still belong inside the Aron Kodesh. Maybe we'll suffer, but we're still going to be inside the Aron Kodesh. Maybe we'll make mistakes, but we'll still be inside the Aron Kodesh. And to think that this holy Jew, that he went to his death at the age of 95, that's what threatened the Third Reich. This man is what threatened the Third Reich, is something which is very, very painful. But I began talking about survivors, and we're going to end talking about survivors. And Elie Wiesel's point about living the lives of those who didn't survive, I think, is so sharp and is so special, and is especially at this point something that we need to keep in mind.